there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking.
My name is John Fullerton. I'm developing an alternative theory of how economies need to work so that they're aligned with how life works.
There are the 8 principles of a regenerative economy that you have proposed. What is a regenerative economy to you? Also, again, in the shortest way you can explain.
This is tough.
A regenerative economy is an economy that operates in accordance with the design principles, the qualities that describes how life works. And that ecologists refer to that as the regenerative process. And so it's often easier to explain it by analogy. So your body is a living system, and your body is regenerating, or we're not having this conversation. Literally, as we speak, at a cellular level, your body is regenerating. And that process is responsible for the miracle of everything around us. And that process works for all living systems at all scales, is what the science tells us. And so my premise is that, the starting point is that despite all of our progress as human beings and all of our economic progress over the last, century, hundreds of years, we're now running into an entirely different context where we're essentially breaking the boundaries of the planet. We're breaching planetary boundaries of all kinds of ecosystem function that is essential for us to live. And the basic premise of traditional economics is that growth, exponential growth, of the economy is the source of our prosperity. But we've reached the limit of how far we can do that without causing accelerating damages. And we've also got an economic system that systematically creates ever-increasing wealth inequality and all kinds of other issues. And so we need to rethink how economies are designed. And my premise is that we're not smart enough to do that, but we have this model everywhere around us that works pretty well by definition, or we wouldn't be here, so that we should learn from how living systems work.
That regenerative economy, would that be an overarching concept that goes global, or is it more local and regional?
Totally global.
Okay.
It will be unique in every context, so it'll look differently in Europe or in Germany than it will in the U.S. or in Africa or Asia. The reason I'm so passionate about getting clear about first principles is that the principles will be constant in Europe and in Asia, but they'll look very different. So it's like, I always like to say every snowflake is unique, but every snowflake looks like a snowflake. So these design principles extend from very small to very big and expand across all contexts, but they show up differently. So, in living systems, there's symbiosis is the term in ecology, but there's symbiotic relationships between the different parts of the system. So there's a symbiotic relationship between your brain and your cardiovascular system, and none of those parts operate on their own. They all work as a connected whole, and so that's a principle that will exist in all different parts of the world, but it'll show up very different based on the local culture or the local geological distinctions.
Yeah, people often make that comparison of regeneration, for example, in the body, in natural systems, etc. But as economy is something that is man-made, if we think one step further, in the process of saying, let's say hypothetically, the world agreed, yes, we want regenerative economics, and then on the way there, or even when implemented, isn't then again the question of if some people, entities will hijack also regenerative economy.
Yeah.
What makes you think it will then stay that way?
So the first thing we need to observe is that implicit in your question is that humans are different than nature. And that's part of this, what some people refer to as a myth of separation. We have a word for nature, like it's an other thing, like there's humans and there's nature. But our latest scientific understanding is actually that we are part of nature, not apart from it. So we're, you know, the problem is that the way we're behaving now is in conflict with how all other living systems work. And the way to govern this is a huge challenge. I don't have answers for how that will work, and I'm not ashamed of that. What I'm arguing is that the fundamental design of our global economic system is designed. It's like an algorithm that's designed to create chaos as opposed to designed to create prosperity, and it's built on a flawed foundation of neoclassical economics, which is based on erroneous and you know, with the benefit of hindsight, ridiculous assumptions about applying Newtonian physics to a human economy, and they're demonstrably wrong. And so if we're gonna start from scratch and think, well, what would a living system-based economy look like, and come up with some design principles, then we essentially have a compass to think about how to sort the mess that we've created for ourselves.
Yeah. Would you favor this change to a regenerative economy or regenerative economies coming from grassroots groups, from the bottom up or top down, saying we're going to maybe influence, inspire, maybe even with those principles, the ones who are already at the top, the most powerful people who, let's say, are guiding right now where economies are going?
You know, I think ultimately it's already happening from a grassroots level. There are lots of things. I'll take a really simple example, farmers markets. Farmers markets, we look at through our current economics lens, and we see them as these kind of quaint little things, and they bring people together and they support farmers, but in fact the whole farmers market movement is the regenerative economy. We just don't call it that because we look at it as farmers markets. There's a example I love to talk about, which is the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain. Been around since like 1940. They're a ecosystem of businesses that are managed collectively as an ecosystem. And so when profits are high over here, some of those profits go over here to support a business that's had a really bad year. When they need more employees, but they have too many employees, they move them from here to here. When they make capital investments, they limit the return on the capital, the financial return on the capital, so that the surplus is distributed in primarily to employees, but also to a fund that is essentially a rainy day fund. Now the world looks at this as an interesting example of cooperative ownership, co-ops in a capitalist system. I look at it and I see the regenerative economy, because they're managing this ecosystem of businesses that collectively are like $20 billion a year in sales, but they're managing them as an ecosystem, as if it's a living system, rather than as individual parts, individual
yeah.
companies that are each trying to maximize.
So something like that you already see as a model, something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the key is that we're not going to have one model that everyone's going to replicate. That's machine age thinking. We're going to have expressions of this happening in very organically in different ways. So in in the Basque Country, the Mondragon Cooperative has expressed itself in one way. That doesn't mean you're supposed to create the Mondragon Cooperatives in Australia. But the principles, if you dug into each of our eight principles, you would see a lot of it showing up in the Mondragon Cooperative today.
Yeah. So could you say that there would be, because I love the fact of local and regional differences, because I think that's often overlooked in a globalized world where people
Perfect example of our neoclassical economics, efficiency-driven, globalization makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
But it's in direct conflict with the principles of how living systems work.
Exactly, and I think that's where those solutions often fail, because you can't make one principle that fits everything. But would you say, with the regional and local differences, keeping them in mind, saying there is one basis without having to explain all the eight principles, which people then can read about, one basis, like it fulfills all human needs and wants. This is obviously just hypothetical, because in the regenerative aspect, we would have to take nature and the animal kingdom into consideration as well. So would you say you could formulate a basis to say that would be the base of the regenerative economies?
I wouldn't frame it that way, because it's so the principle I talk about is honor community and place, right? But that doesn't mean that that's the first principle or the base principle. And in fact, there's a lot of work around local economy, as you're obviously aware. But if you think about, again, our bodies, we have a circulatory system that includes two very large arteries, a bunch of medium-sized veins, and a bunch of tiny little capillaries to get our oxygen out into the local parts of our body. So it's not that we don't want two big arteries. We do. So I'm not against the global economy. There are things that we need to have at a global scale. The internet wouldn't work as a group of regional networks. And the internet is probably the most regenerative innovation in our lifetimes. But we don't see it as regenerative. But the internet facilitates the circulation of information and even emotion. We share pictures around. That's the future of regenerative economy. The problem is that we then allow Mark Zuckerberg to slap a business model on it that is highly extractive. So the internet becomes a vehicle for the extractive economy to perpetuate itself.
Exactly, that goes again into that question, which we don't have to discuss again, but that's always my thinking, you know, who is going to stop people like that to hijack also local, regional?
And I don't have an answer for that, you know, and here I'm moving from sort of the idea that if we need to design our economy in alignment with how living systems work, and that we understand living systems through science, and that understanding has now come full circle to be in alignment with the indigenous wisdom that is innate in all of us. The fact that those are in alignment and neoclassical economics is in conflict tells me that it's self-evident truth that we need to shift and align with how living systems work.
Yeah.
But if that's true, then it doesn't mean it's true that the institutions we have today are capable of doing that. The institutions we have today arose most recently out of the post-World War II, you know, the response to the World War II and the desecration that happened, and we don't want that to happen again, so let's construct the institutional framework that's going to be based on trade, and we're not going to kill each other because we're trading with each other, and we need... And so there was this whole neoclassical economics framework underlying the structure of institutions today. The World Bank, the IMF, the G20, all that stuff. Well, the context is totally different today than it was post-World War II. There's this planetary crisis, ecological crisis, and there's massive inequality, and there's about to be massive migration. So the context demands a different institutional structure, but no one's talking about what institutions don't even exist that we'll need to manage this new structure. Because our response is, well, either government's going to fix it or the market will fix it. And mostly, at least in America, we've lost faith in government, so the answer has to be markets and the private sector. But that's a ridiculous, it's absurd to think that the free market is going to solve this when we know what the free market does.
So for the sake of effectiveness in the context, as you said, which we have today, where we have sort of like a deadline, because it's a very different context, because
right.
it's literally extinction at the very worst, at the very end. So right now we have this limited time frame where we have to make a lot of changes. So would you say, for the sake of effectiveness, change within existing systems and institutions still radical, or a complete overhaul and saying we have to, in order for this to work, then also maybe longer term, or just as an interim solution, to create completely new systems, since we don't have all
yeah.
the time in the world to think about this?
Well, I guess I would say a couple things. One, we're already too late. So we're in a massive transformation. So I'm not a believer that we have 10 years, or now we only have 8 years. You know, net 2050 is a joke. I mean, we're completely lost. And so the reality is we're going to go into a period that's going to last the rest of both of our lives, that's going to be increasingly chaotic, which doesn't mean everyone's going to die. But it is going to be, I mean, just look what's happened in the last week. I mean, you know, In Libya.
Libya, in Italy.
I don't even know what
happened. We have a lot of refugees Italy, more than ever.
Yeah. So, I mean, welcome to our life. This is reality. We're in it. It's not in 10 years. It's now. And so, you know, all of us rushing to Climate Week and what we're doing, what we're doing is not working. And if I were to, you know, if I were to be in charge of the world for a year, the first thing I would do is to try to establish, and when I say institution, I mean like the private sector is an institution, capitalism is an institution, government is an institution. We need an institution of the commons. And to pretend that we can manage the free enterprise system of a global economy with 8 billion people, most of whom barely scratch out a living, and do that without some governance of the commons, and I define the commons broader than just the woods and the rivers and the grasslands, but I think of also the commons. The internet is a commons. The cumulative technological advance of humanity is, as Peter Barnes is one of my inspirations. You know, you were born into a different world than I was. We were both born into a world where there's oxygen and we can breathe and there's forests, but you were born into a world where the internet existed. The internet didn't exist when I was born. So that's now co-inherited wealth that you inherited just by being born. And we've allowed the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world to expropriate it and use it to extract from all of us and make our kids sick. That's not okay. And so if you want to use the internet and create a massive enterprise using the internet, if the internet was a commons, first of all, Facebook would be charged a user fee, just like if you want to go fishing in the fishery, you get charged a user fee. And there'd be a governing body over the commons that wasn't a politically elected body. It had a seventh generation mindset. It had a legal fiduciary responsibility to govern the commons in a way that was, in such a way that would protect that commons, just like we protect fisheries. Well, why can't we have an institutional approach to managing the commons, both the natural commons and the technological commons? And what that'll do is it'll create, it'll essentially charge what people are using for free. You know, the internet is co-inherited. But Zuckerberg is making a gazillion dollars on it, and I'm not, because he's using it, and I'm not.
Then there's again the question of the who, to get maybe very practical, because I think what people are missing today is exact steps, because people talk about concepts and goals, but it's it's often not enough. Who would fund those institutions?
So goals are very different than ideas. I'm very cynical about goals. Goals are we manage a machine. We want the machine to be productive. We set a goal, and we don't make any of our goals. The problem is we haven't slowed down to reconceive the design principles of an economy that works the way life works. And that's not about goals. That's about first principles, design principles, patterns. And we need to slow down and stop rushing to conferences and saying, what are our new goals this year? You know, how many COPs have there been? You know this. How many goals? How many COPs have there been?
I have been to one COP.
But how many have there been? We're at COP 27?
COP 28.
28. So we're about to have our 28th.
Rushing around.
World, you know, airplanes everywhere. We're going to set new goals.
Yeah.
And, we're not making our SDGs. We're not aligned with the Paris COP. We're not. And it's because we haven't slowed down to actually redesign the system. And I could tick off a laundry list of very practical, tangible policy requirements to begin to shift the economy more in alignment with living systems. I'll just use one as an example and then explain why it doesn't work. So I spent, after the financial crisis, 2 years going down to Washington and giving talks about why we needed a financial transaction tax. But I used a living systems rationale. If speculation, by definition, speculation is one person wins, one person loses, right? We talked earlier about symbiosis. So speculation, in contrast with investment, is, real investment is highly aligned with living systems. It's circulation, it's recycling of, in this case, financial capital, building new, it's how evolution happens. But speculation is a game where you win and I lose, or I win and you lose. And that's, by definition, not working in right relationship. There's no win-win in speculation. The financial markets have become essentially a massive speculative playground. And a financial transaction tax, which is not a new idea, won't fix it, but it'll discourage a lot of it and earn a lot of fees from those that do that activity that can be recycled into better uses. So I went down to Washington and argued with the Treasury Department of the Obama administration, arguably the good guys who were on our team, and they're trapped in their neoclassical framework, and their response, as I expected, was, well, that'll hurt market efficiency. And market efficiency is the key to growth. And if we don't want to hurt efficiency, because then we won't have growth, and then we won't have prosperity. So they don't understand. They have a machine logic from neoclassical economics, and they don't understand the complexity of how living systems work.
Yeah. So, because as I said, then you obviously need people, maybe like you, like many other people, who will be, because that's a question of who will make those policies. People have to have understand regeneration, have to be
right.
Genuine, because as we see, there's a lot of greenwashing. As you said, ESG sometimes or often it's a little not neither here nor there. Now, a little more personal question, but I think it's really important to ask this, is you had a 20-year career on Wall Street as a managing director of what you called the old JP Morgan. And you said you had this voice in the back of your head, which maybe for a long time you ignored. How did you say, okay, I want to explore a different system? Because many people may be in these positions, and isn't then that also would be a good thing to say, we inspire people like that, you with your lectures, other people going around spreading the message and getting people to understand there's something different that could, which everyone could thrive more on, even the people in high-rise buildings who think they're doing well for themselves, but the collective is still important for us humans. So how would you say that happened for you? Why did you say, I want change?
You've obviously done your homework. I must have said I have a voice in my head more than one in one place around me. But yeah, I had an intuition that it was, I wasn't doing what I was meant to do with my life. And I didn't go to Wall Street to make money. Most people think that everyone goes to Wall Street to make money. I actually went to Wall Street because when I was in college, this idea of globalization was like the next big thing. And the professor I had suggested that as a premise that as a result of globalization, it'll be economics and finance that will become the kind of the vehicle of international relations more than politics. So I switched my major from international relations to economics, and I went and got a job at J.P. Morgan, what was then called Morgan Garrett and Trust Company, because it was the most prestigious bank, and you know, people worked there, and then they went to the World Bank, and it was like there was a purpose to it beyond making money. And then I got sucked into the "we're here to make money" machine, and then Morgan transformed to an investment bank, and then the money got bigger, and so the money got more enticing. And I rode the derivatives wave, which was very exciting when it first started. But then I sort of woke up and said, you know, what am I doing? And the business became less fun, much more. The word I use is violent. I mean, it's violent. And what happened in the financial crisis is violence on steroids, unrecognizable to me. But I just felt I didn't want to be there anymore, and so I left and just started following my intuition. And you know, I mean, this is a longer story, but there was just a bunch of synchronicities, one of which was meeting Alan Savory. But I didn't decide to go meet Alan Savory. I wrote a piece on E.F. Schumacher, and someone sent it to Alan Savory, and I get an email from Alan Savory out of the blue. And I don't care about cows and pastures and grasslands, but he wants to come see me and talk about my paper, and before you know it, we're building a business together, and he's teaching me about holistic grazing, which has nothing to do with anything I have an interest in. But then I have this idea, shoot, if this works on the grasslands, maybe the living system called the economy, it'll work for that too. So I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a goal. I started just listening to intuition, whatever. And it works. But most of us are too busy to slow down and listen.
Yeah, do you think it works to speak to the conscience of, let's say, what formerly were your colleagues, to say, if you present them with a different idea, that many people are not, let's say, bad, greedy people are just running after money, but to say, if I see a new idea and somebody shows me a pathway, I'm willing and open to learn, that it's more about that people start compromising too much in those positions and one day wake up and are in a position they never really wanted to be.
Yeah. What do I think about that? I think we have to be honest, and when you are living in the culture we live in, where money is important, and you hand a young person an opportunity where they can make 5-10 times more money than if they do something, you know, if they go there instead of there, it's all hard work, and here you get paid 5 times more than there, they're going to do it. And we've set up an economy and a culture where you need money to survive and to be happy, at least some amount of money. And so I don't blame young people at all to feel they need to jump into that. But increasingly, it's very clear to me from talking to young people that they do it against, with full knowledge that they're sacrificing what they really want to do because they need to make money. Some of them to pay off their student loans, some of them because they feel they need to. And to me, that's violence to humanity.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm finding is that as things get harder, as the pressure is rising, more and more people are willing to question why they're doing that. And I joke about the course, but one of the KPIs in the course, which we don't talk about KPIs in regenerative economics, but I do in this case, one of the KPIs is how many people quit their jobs after the course. And there's a lot. And there's a lot more also that have quit their jobs before the course. And so people are hungry and searching. And I'm proud to say there are two of my former colleagues from the old Morgan who showed up in the course this time. I had no idea they were coming.
Yeah. It's the same, I would say, in agriculture. If you show farmers the ways, I mean, also in the US now, there's this big wave next to an increasing, let's say, the violent industrial agriculture complex, where that narrative is also increasing. We need more input, more machines to feed the world. And on the other side, the farms that are going regenerative, as you said, regenerating grasslands, etc., which is basically nothing new because it was done hundreds and thousands
of years before. Buffaloes have been doing it for a long time.
Yes, exactly. But no one, I would say, who's gone to be a regenerative farmer ever said, no, I'm going back. I don't think that ever happened. So last question I want to know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, regenerative farmers struggle. I mean, farming is hard, and
100%. No one says that farming isn't hard, but I think with all the examples you can see and the stories you can read of people who have really gotten the right training, the right support, you can make a more stable income.
Yeah.
You have a slower every day, and I mean, amongst farmers are some of the highest suicides, so I think anything that is a little better is still better. So
yeah, and the challenge here is that, you know, you can't go make $10 million a year the way you can at Goldman Sachs.
Yes,
doing,
of course,
finance in a way that is actually in service to a regenerative economy. It's
just
the reason you get to make $10 million is because you're extracting.
Yes.
And so you can't do that.
Yeah.
You need some new rules to make it much harder to do.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so last question, Grasslands LLC. It said...
She's done her homework.
It said on the website, which caught my eye, which was ecological integrity and financial viability. And you before already mentioned the term of fiduciary responsibility, which is something you hear a lot. As you said, money matters. It matters a lot. And that's always a concern with investors, as you are also an impact investor. People want to shift, many of them, to more impact investing, making a positive impact, as you said, also having a feeling, okay, I'm doing something here that is of importance. So what would you want to say to investors and shareholders about investing in regenerative ventures? There are more and more investment management companies also that where you can now invest in regeneration, but what's the return on that? You know, how do you invest in regeneration? So could you explain why that should be interesting to any investor, maybe even the ones that are more of the conservative?
So it's a huge question. I mean, that's a whole course right there. So what shall I say? I guess the first thing I'd say is that this is, again, you know, the whole paradigm, the unquestioned assumption is that all investments should generate the highest risk-adjusted return possible. And if you don't do that, you're stupid. And so me, wealth manager, I'm going to help you do that because that's the point of investing. And we have to question... That's the game we've set up. The game works pretty well. The people that have access to the best ideas do the best investing. And we've now got a stock of financial capital that is orders of magnitude higher relative to the size of the economy. The size of the economy is a multiple of what it was when I was born. I forget the numbers, but it's probably five times or more what it was when I was born. More than that. And the amount of financial capital, just measured the stock of financial capital, all the stocks and bonds, all the financial assets, is a multiple higher relative to this bigger economy than it was when I was born. So we've created a system that that essentially converts natural capital and social capital into financial capital. And that pile of financial capital is now massive. And next year it'll be bigger. And the reason is because all of that financial capital behaves in the way that we just talked about, which is the point is to invest in such a way that maximizes risk-adjusted return. Now, that makes total sense for a pensioner for 95% of the planet. But most of the capital is controlled by 5% of the planet. And we're at a point where, I'm sorry, you can't keep doing that, or you'll destroy this thing for everybody, including life on this planet. And so the first part of answering your question is we have to question that core assumption about what's the purpose of capital. But more practically, for your father, for me, for you, for all of us, there's certainly investments that can be made in innovative companies that are doing regenerative activities where your returns will be as good as anything else you'll do. And I'll give you an example. I'm invested in a company called Myland. They're based on researchers who've been working with algae for, 25 years. And most algae research was trying to use algae for energy, turn it into gasoline. Well, it turns out that's hard to do for reasons I couldn't explain. But in the process, they learned that algae works really well as a stimulant in agriculture. And so they've set up a technology where they take soil, they extract the algae out of the soil. So they're using native algae, because the algae over there is going to be different than the algae over there. They then grow it in a big tube, and I'm simplifying, and then they put it back out onto the farm through the agricultural system, big industrial farms. And they've learned that doing that, essentially they're growing soil, because algae is essentially food for soil. And the soil scientists are shocked at how effective this is, which means that the soil is retaining more water, which means it's sequestering more carbon, which means it's growing healthier products and growing, like strawberries grow double the size that they used to. And the energy savings alone on irrigation more than pays for the system, and all the rest is upside. So this company is going to be a very successful company, and I'll earn venture capital returns on it. So regenerative doesn't mean no opportunity for, high returns. But I also increasingly am comfortable investing money in fairly low-risk renewable energy projects that are not going to generate big high returns. But I'm comfortable having my capital invested in what I know is the infrastructure that needs to be financed.
Yeah.
And it's resilient, it's stable cash flows, and I'm actually not going to, it's not going to change my life that I don't earn 19% next year rather than 12%.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, if it's still enough, if the return is enough,
right,
it should be enough for everyone, but not everybody thinks that way,
no.
So I'm asking for
But if you're a multi-billionaire, you should have a different return objective than
sure.
if you're me.
Yeah.
And if you're, struggling to pay your bills every week, you shouldn't be taking risk with your small savings that you're trying to. So it's again, the context matters. And what the finance industry has done is told that all of us that our goal is to maximize a return and put your money here, put your money there. But what they're really doing is churning our money and extracting fees out of it. Frankly, including the whole ESG industrial complex. It's a massive excuse to get you to put your money, take it out of here and put it over there, and they charge higher fees over there. And they sold it to us as you're going to get higher returns or just as good returns and you're going to save the planet. Well, no, it's not saving the planet. And the returns were higher because they got super invested in tech instead of oil and gas. When oil and gas went down, tech went up. So they got lucky.
Yeah.
But they misled us by thinking that our investments were actually going to change the system. And they knew better.
Okay. So let's end this on a good note. One quick fire question. What is something that you're, some development, some news you're extremely excited about that you say if there's anything that gives you hope, that's one big thing?
Oh, gosh. Lots of things. Honestly, I have three kids of my own, and so I have despair, but also hope about this next generation. I think, you know, some young people are knuckleheads and doing what young knuckleheads do, but I find when I talk about this to young people, anyone under 30, they haven't bought into, you know, they're not stupid. They look around and say, this thing isn't working. And somehow what I have to say just makes total sense. Whereas when I try to go speak to, you know, a seasoned banker or a seasoned business person, particularly if they're successful and particularly if they're male, they just, you know, it's like, I can't, they don't know what to do with it. And it used to be they think I'm nuts. Now they think, it's too big. You know, they say things to me, they literally say it's too big.
Yeah.
I can't. And understandably, you know, they're like, I got a quarterly report to do. I got, you know, we're in this. And they've got a lot at stake. They've got a big job. They got a family. They got a mortgage, whatever. So to answer your question, it's really, you know, the younger generation, and it's totally unfair that for people like me to say, well, these guys will figure it out. I don't at all think that. But you asked me what gives me hope, and it's you know, the next generation is just much more tuned into this than my generation is.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.